I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Charles Lichtman, author of the new thriller, The Sword of David. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We're entering the last full week of the Jewish year 5781, and what a year it has been. And that's not necessarily said in a good way. 5781 began in full pandemic mode before there were any vaccines, with the most unusual high holy days any of us had ever experienced. Instead of large gatherings of full sanctuaries, services were either held as small groups, fully masked and practicing social distancing, like at my own congregation Beit Simcha, or totally online with a virtual service and shofar blowing and Torah readings and so on, enacted in green rooms or living rooms or recording studios or wherever rabbis and cantors could set up shop and do their Rosh Hashanah thing. Last Rosh Hashanah, my congregation Beit Simcha here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, held a wonderful second night drive-in Rosh Hashanah celebration, which was great. Not least because people could actually be together outdoors, enjoying both Judaism and each other for the first time in many months. But it took a lot of creativity to make anything that seemed remotely like normal when there were safety limits on having more than 25 people together at one time. Well, at least there were for synagogues. That was back at the start of this Jewish year. And after vaccinations and the slow beginnings of more normalcy, an efflorescence of hope that after a brutal year of illness, death, and isolation and general weirdness, things this coming year would really be back to what we were all used to before we all became amateur virologists. And yet now 5781 is ending in the midst of a confused, messy Delta variant surge that has left some Jews nearly as unsure of what to do about attending services on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur as they were last year. I know that Jews are about the most vaccinated population of any group in the United States. We definitely know Israel is one of the most vaccinated of all countries in the world, that it has even administered booster shots to at-risk populations already and to those over 60 years old. We also know that while the Delta variant is a serious problem, you are something like 30 times less likely to get seriously ill from it if you are vaccinated than if you are not. That means that if you follow reasonable precautions, are vaccinated, wear masks in public spaces, if not necessarily when sitting with your family or a friend group during services, don't hug and kiss everybody at High Holy Days like you would usually do, well, then you are probably in good shape to actually come to Shul and pray on these most important Jewish days of all. Look, there are always trade-offs in life. There is no reason to endanger your life or to test whether the classic prayer from the morning service, Parosh Hashanah, Mi Yichyeh Mi Yamut, who shall live, who shall die, who by disease, and so on, to see if that will apply to you just because you came to synagogue on Yontif. But using good sense and following reasonable practices, attending and praying on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, well, that's a very important thing to do, a meaningful way to break the isolation and strangeness of this past year and resume full participation in real and supportive religious community. And of course, all synagogues will continue to broadcast services to those who can't make it to temple or don't feel safe doing so, and that's probably going to be true forever after. Still, there is something unique and precious about coming in person to pray for a return to goodness and meaning. This year, tshuva may be a return to precious normalcy. That is something worth praying for. To play us in this morning for the coming High Holy Days, here's an interesting version of Baruch Hashanah from the temple I grew up in, more or less, Temple Emmanuel of Beverly Hills, California, a blend of that classic Baruch Hashanah prayer and Leonard Cohen's interpretation of that text.
Baruch Hashanah,
we
That was Barosh Hashanah for the coming High Holy Days, beginning Monday night, September 6th, at a synagogue near you. You can call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675 for information about my own congregation, Beit Simcha, which is meeting both in person and, of course, online. When we return on Too Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Charles Lichtman, will tell us what inspired him to write his new thriller about, well, the Temple Mount and, oh, all kinds of stuff. It's called The Sword of David. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. New Progressive Congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses of all kinds, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for our in-person High Holy Day service or on our Facebook Live broadcast by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to register. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely and in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information or to sign up for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Friday nights at 6:30 p.m., Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. with Torah study beforehand at 9 a.m. You can email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Again, Shabbat evening services, 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Our High Holy Day services you have to register for, but we'd be delighted to have you join us. All with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. We will continue to have services with full music in person and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those at the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available. Just got started now. Religious school and Torah Tykes programs are available in blended formats, some students live and some on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our wonderful religious school and Torah Tykes programs, High Holy Day services, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person or on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest, fastest growing, and warmest Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Charles Lichtman is the author of the new book, The Sword of David. To call it a thriller does not capture just how colorful the book is. This is your first novel, if I'm not mistaken?
Actually, it's my second novel.
Your
first novel was the last inauguration, and that was also a thriller.
Another thriller, okay. Charles Lichtman is on the National Board of Directors of the Secure Community Network, an arm of the Jewish Federations of North America, responsible for protecting Jewish buildings and people throughout the United States. He has twice been recognized as a Lawyer of the Year and founded a National Voter Protection Program. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning to you, and thank you for having me. I much appreciate it.
So tell us about the evolution of the Sword of David, which ranges across the Middle East, lots of interesting and fascinating archaeological and mystical elements. Give us a little background.
Well, I've been writing about terrorism and studying it since I was literally a teenager following the Munich Olympics, and I wanted to write a Middle East espionage thriller that was different than everybody else's. And because of my love of Israel and my fear of what bad could happen in Israel from our enemies there, I wanted to focus on a bigger picture story. So I came up with a way to incorporate some biblical themes, and especially including the Ark of the Covenant and the Ten Commandments, and that would have a unifying purpose in the world.
The concept that the Ark of the Covenant has been discovered was used in a movie, as I recall. Few people may remember it, Raiders of the Lost Ark. This has been a theme in a variety of texts for a while. How did you decide that this was going to be central to your book, without giving away too much here?
Well, of course, people remember Raiders of the Lost Ark, but having studied a fair amount of Jewish archaeology, I know that history reports that the Ark was lost when Nebuchadnezzar took out Israel, or, we'll call it, it was like 670 B.C. or whatever date was.
Yeah, 586 sometimes.
586, but,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
And,
yeah.
And to me, there's nothing that would be more substantial to the world than the Ark of the Covenant. So it's very early in the book, but I have the hero of the book find it buried inside the Temple Mount after a terrorist explosion at the wall. And I theorized that it could be buried in the Temple Mount because the Torah the Torah provides the direction on how an ark could be built. So conceivably, even though the original ark disappeared in 586, there was nothing to prevent the high priest in Jerusalem from rebuilding a new ark and keeping that on the Temple Mount. And that, so I describe what happened to it in my prologue, which is an explanation of what the Romans do to Jerusalem in 70 AD. And that is what jumpstarts the book onto this quest for finding the Ten Commandments, and ties to the War Scroll, which many of your listeners may realize actually exists and provides for the Jewish form of the apocalypse, with the Battle of the Sons of Light versus the Sons of Darkness.
Dead Sea Scrolls, right. Yeah, we will get into that and much more when we return on To Jewish with Charles Lichtman, the author of the book, The Sword of David, a thriller. We'll be back in just a moment. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, tojewishradio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation, and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started speaking last week about the Silk Road, which from antiquity through the Middle Ages, really almost up to modernity, had a very important trade function. You mentioned last time that Sarajevo was the westernmost terminus of it, which certainly explains an important Jewish community in that important trading area, and that the easternmost edge of this land, Silk Route, was maybe Xi'an. There's some debate about that.
Right. And what we didn't really address was, along this route, what role did the Jews play? Because when the Mediterranean was a Roman lake, they were ship's chandlers, ship's suppliers, etc., etc. When the main routes of trade changed from being waterborne on the Mediterranean to landborne across the middle of Asia, first of all, there were some older Jewish communities, like we talked about once before, in Afghanistan, for example, in Bukhara, in Samarkand, in places which today are Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, etc., etc. The one place that many people think was on the Silk Route that probably wasn't really is Baku, which is the capital of Azerbaijan. Baku has a large and significant Jewish community for different reasons, and actually mainly from the time that it was part of the Tsarist or so-called Russian Empire. But these other cities often had ancient Jewish communities which saw the opportunities in providing lodgings, fresh camels, food, basically being innkeepers and suppliers of vessels, the vessel being the camel rather than the ships.
Yeah. Provisioners and kind of like ship's chandlers.
Right, exactly. But
in a coastal way, but on land. Yeah. Right. Like the camel is the land ship.
Right. So, you know, there are a lot of mountains and deserts along this route. So generally speaking, the routes taken by people to go to cross the Silk Road tried to avoid extended periods in the desert or the mountains because it was just more tiring, more time-consuming, more dangerous, etc. So that's why alternative routes developed. There's sort of a northern, a middle, and a southern, and then lots of sub-variations. But the key cities along this route all have Jewish communities that are famous for one reason or another. And even Xi'an, if you visit the middle of Xi'an, there's a part that looks like a Middle Eastern city with a bazaar and the smells of Middle Eastern food cooking. And it reflects more a connectedness with the Middle East, actually with, let's say, Turkey or with Iran, than it does with the rest of China. And it's a fascinating place to visit. No longer has much of a Jewish community, but it certainly has visible remains of the Jewish community that was once there.
Thanks, Tom. Maybe next time we look at some of those intermediate communities between the Western and Eastern termini of this route, which are also quite interesting. Thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. In the days when the samurai were the elite warriors of Japan, there was a powerful emperor who needed a new chief samurai. He had three finalists for the job: a Japanese samurai, a Chinese samurai, and a Jewish samurai. The emperor asked the Japanese samurai to demonstrate why he should be the next chief samurai. The Japanese samurai opened a matchbox and out popped a bumblebee. Whoosh went his sword, and the bumblebee dropped dead on the ground in two pieces. The emperor exclaimed, "That is impressive." Then the Chinese samurai came in to demonstrate why he should be chosen. Chinese samurai opened a matchbox too, and out buzzed a fly. Whoosh, whoosh went his sword, and the fly dropped dead on the ground in four small pieces. The emperor exclaimed, "That is really very impressive." Next, the emperor turned to the Jewish samurai and asked him also to demonstrate why he should be the next head samurai. The Jewish samurai also opened a matchbox, and out flew a gnat. His flashing sword went whoosh, but the gnat still flew. The emperor exclaimed with disappointment, "But the gnat is still alive." And the Jewish samurai smiled and said, "Circumcision is not meant to kill." That was a classic version of the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In this week's portion of Nitzavim, Moses is nearing the end of his leadership and his life. It gives a special poignancy to his message. It is the last will and testament of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses on management, if you will. What will Moses teach us about how to carry on after he's gone? How will our greatest leader pass the baton? To whom will he give it? The answer comes quickly, and it is a little bit of a surprise. Here in Nitzavim, Moses' great message is not that he is passing the mantle of control to Joshua, which would not be a surprise. No, he does that. But the central teaching is that of leadership through empowerment. Each Israelite can grasp the central concept of our contract with God and fulfill it. Every single Jew has the capacity to fulfill the Torah, our commitment to God. Each of us has the responsibility to do so and the choice to carry it out or not. And that thousands of years old lesson has meaning for us today. What makes this particularly appropriate is that we are close to completing Deuteronomy, a text filled with ethical and moral laws of personal conduct. Give to the poor, stranger, and orphan, and the widow. Treat employees with generosity, kindness, and respect. Protect others against negligence. Deal honestly in business and with others. Be gracious and moral in your treatment of animals. Reward loyalty. Do not seek to humiliate others. Live a life of commitment to your ideals. Keep your word. Keep your vows. Of course, we don't have to actually do any of this, as Moses states so clearly in God's name here in Nitzavim. We can choose to do otherwise, to act unethically. And that will simply create a terrible world. Institutions not worthy of respect. Personal lives of deception and dishonor. We can choose not to support the needy, to ignore the homeless, to leave those who teach Torah without the means of support to do their essential work. It will always be our choice. We are approaching the time for tshuva, return and repentance. Slichot was last night. Rosh Hashanah just over a week away. And the message in our portion is clear. This Torah of ours is not too hard for us. It is not too far from us. It is here, now, close, in our hands. And it's up to us to learn it, live it, and do it. Not a bad final speech from Moses for this last Shabbat of the year. Not a bad lesson for the end of this year, or for the beginning of next year, or any time. When we come back, our guest, Charles Lichtman, author of the new thriller, The Sword of David, tells us how he came up with his shocking surprise ending to this Israel-based novel and how it just might lead to another sequel. Find out when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett met with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington, D.C. last week, the first formal meeting of the two since Bennett became the head of the Israeli government this year. In a get-better-acquainted meeting, the talks included discussion limiting Iran's nuclear capability, as well as assuring some kind of regional stability. To be honest, Afghanistan is fortunately not in the same region as Israel. They also talked about climate change, an issue on both leaders' agendas. To provide historical perspective, this marks the first time that the prime minister representing Israel in a meeting with the U.S. president hasn't been Bibi Netanyahu since Ehud Olmert met with George W. Bush in 2008 or so. Basically, a kid born the last time an Israeli prime minister, not Netanyahu, met with a U.S. president. Well, that kid is now being bar mitzvahed. By all accounts, the meeting went pretty well. In tragic news, 17-year-old Shmuel Silverberg, a yeshiva student in Denver, was murdered last week during a brutal shooting perpetrated by five escaped convicts on a crime spree. The senseless killing was part of a series of carjacking, thefts, and assaults that included those convicts trying to force their way into the yeshiva where Silverberg was studying. Four of the five criminals had been arrested by Denver police. The fifth is being vigorously sought. The authorities do not believe the murder was a hate crime or consciously directed at Jews, but it is a terrible incident. Our thoughts and prayers are with the family of the murdered young man. May they find consolation. May his memory be a blessing. Israel's chief rabbinate has asked Pope Francis to retract a recent comment about Jewish law that it said might lead Catholic listeners to derogatory conclusions about Jews. Rabbi Ratzon Arusi, chair of the chief rabbinate's commission for interreligious affairs, sent a formal letter to the Vatican expressing concerns about an August 11th lecture there on God giving the Torah to the Jews. God offered them the Torah, the law, so they could understand his will and live in justice, Francis said in his homily, according to a translation of the remarks provided by the Vatican. We have to think that at that time a law like this was necessary. It was a tremendous gift that God gave his people. What he said next is the questionable part. The law, however, does not give life. It does not offer the fulfillment of the promise because it is not capable of being able to fulfill it, the Pope said. The law is a journey that leads towards an encounter. Those who seek life need to look to the promise and to its fulfillment in, Christ. The letter from Arusi was addressed to Cardinal Kurt Koch, whose department at the Vatican handles Jewish relations. In his homily, the Pope presents the Christian faith as not just superseding the Torah, but asserts that the latter no longer gives life, implying that Jewish religious practice in the present era is rendered obsolete, said Arusi. This is in effect part and parcel of the teaching of contempt towards Jews and Judaism that we thought had been fully repudiated by the Church. Arusi asked to convey our distress to Pope Francis, requesting that the Pope act to ensure that any derogatory conclusions drawn from this homily are clearly repudiated. Koch's office said last week that he was considering the letter seriously and reflecting on a response. Look, The Pope is perhaps the leading proponent of Christianity and certainly of Roman Catholicism in the world. You wouldn't expect him to think otherwise than that it represents the best way to be, the best way to be in religion, and the best way to seek God. But putting the concept of supersession, the idea that Christianity replaced Judaism with something quote-unquote better, when that particular doctrine has been used to violently attack Jews, forcing conversions and executions and, well, genocide for nearly 2,000 years by some Christians, and doing so in those terms in a public papal homily, is indeed very problematic. Pope Francis enjoys a good reputation when it comes to Catholic-Jewish relations. He co-authored a book with a rabbi many years ago when he was still the archbishop of his native Buenos Aires. Last month, Pope Francis acted to restrict the use of the Latin Mass, a liturgical form that calls for the conversion of Jews and refers to Jewish blindness. So we can hope he will respond to this issue soon and actively. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world.
This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? In three fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings you the joy of Jewish life and learning. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. Plus, you can get a sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are at the Tucson JCC, the J, and are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but the learning is invaluable. Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try some delicious Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. There's no charge, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sunday afternoons in September and October at the Tucson JCC. There's a free Zoom option, but registration is required. All classes are with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, there's no obligation, and registration is completely free for this wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Register for This Is Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. It's the most effective introduction to Jewish learning and life ever. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Charles Lichtman, is the author of the new book, The Sword of David, a thriller, his second novel. It's a dramatic tale that involves Israelis, Palestinians, Catholics. It ranges across the Middle East, across Europe, kind of across the world. When you're putting this together, how do you keep track of everything?
Well, in this book, it was unique because I outlined the book backwards as opposed to forward. I knew how I wanted to end the book, and which I won't tell everybody because that would ruin the story, and I'm sure that no one has written this ending at all, ever before. So I had to figure out how could I get to the ending in a logical progression. So I studied architecture a bit. I studied archaeology a bit. I studied a lot of history, particularly the Knights Templar, who, you know, everybody knows was digging around the Temple Mount around the 1080s and supposedly found something of, you know, great value that they took to the Pope and made them the most powerful group in the world. So I incorporated all those themes to get where I needed to be, and it took me to London, Paris, Rome, Ethiopia. Ethiopia might be of particular interest because it had long been stated that the Queen of Sheba, King Solomon's wife, that her son had taken, Menelik had taken the Ark of the Covenant to Ethiopia. So I had to track that down.
I interviewed a guy, Tudor Parfit, once, who wrote a book, sadly he's gone, about the lost Ark of the Covenant. He traced it to, southern Africa, actually. And his description of the Ark was that it was kind of a weapon in the ancient world. That's an interesting interpretation. There's a lot of stuff out there on this. What do you think the Ark of the Covenant was?
I think the Ark of the Covenant was exactly as was described in the five books of Moses, that it was built to prescription, and the first Ark was built by the Israelites when they came out of Egypt, and that after its loss to Nebuchadnezzar, it was rebuilt, and it was used to potentially, if the Ten Commandments existed, to either hold them, or conversely, it was the means by which God could communicate with the Israelites at all points in time.
In you've dealt with security matters, as you've mentioned, really through your whole career. Israel is one of the more complex security locations in the world. In your book, you have Hezbollah, lots of contemporary threats. Do you think peace is possible in the Middle East, particularly peace between Israel and its enemies?
I wouldn't say never. I think it's very difficult presently. But we've made peace with many of the countries in the Middle East. And I would even foresee there be some prospect down the road, not in the immediate future, with Iran. The new leader doesn't seem, I think, to be conducive to a peace with Israel. But you don't know what happens 10 years or 15 years down the road, especially if the Iranians are suffering and they see the benefits to peace that the Saudis will benefit from, as well as the other countries like UAE that have made peace with Israel. I think the greater threat will always remain the terrorists that don't belong to a country. And it's hard to say how we could extinguish them. But I want to be optimistic about it. From a realistic standpoint, I don't see it in the immediate future.
Let's talk about the title of the book, The Sword of David, and how you added that element. I guess it's not added since it's in the title. We've got the Lost Ark of the Covenant, the Ten Commandments, and the Sword of David. Tell us how you fixed on including that in this story.
Well, I'll start with King David. When I made my first trip to Israel, our tour guide stopped at this huge field in Israel, and all of my family, we went on this great big trip with like 18 family members, and we got off the bus, and the tour guide said, "Who knows what happened here?" And nobody knew, and he said, "This is where David slew Goliath." And then he picked up a stone, and he handed it to my daughter, and he said, "I know, this is the stone that David used to kill Goliath." And the story, the way he told it, blew me away, and I became fascinated and read up about King David. And by most accounts, King David took Goliath's sword, and it was a mighty sword, and I used it purely in a fictional way in the story to show the power of the sword and the power of God. And I don't want to say more than that because it would ruin the story for the reader, but it plays an absolutely critical role in bringing everything together.
How long did it take you to write The Sword of David?
Oh, that's a bad question, and that's because it took me 15 years, and that's because I was working 60 to 70 hours a week in my law practice. I was helping to run elections. I was trying to raise my family, and I was trying to have some time to myself. And it was just always, it by necessity, had to be my lowest priority. And then I got tired of saying, oh, forget it. And I sat down one day and said, now I'm going to finish the book. So I actually finished and edited the book multiple times in the space of about 2 years. But it took me a while to get to that point.
What was your favorite part about that writing process? It's a tough question after 15 years of struggle.
I was born to be a writer, and I've always loved writing, but my favorite part of this book was piecing together all these fictional components to get to an ending that I wanted the reader to read, absorb, and say, oh, I love this. This is unique, and I've not seen anything like it, and it's going to be rewarding to the reader. So that's what my favorite part was connecting the dots.
What was the most surprising part as you completed the book and filled in the gaps and all of the things you have to do, particularly on a very complicated and intricate thriller like this? What was the most surprising part of this for you?
That I actually think I got it right. But I do. I think that as I connected the dots and as I worked it forward and backward, while of course it's fictional, it's logically fictional.
I thought a little bit of the Gabriel Alone stories, or who influenced you the most in writing this?
So I've read a lot of Daniel Silva, and I have great admiration for him. And I've read Fleming and Tom Clancy and Muslim and five other spy writers besides them. And they all influenced me a little bit, but I didn't want to write what they wrote, which is there's a good guy, there's a bad guy, there's a terrible story, and at the end, the good guy kills the bad guy. I did not want to write that story. So they all influenced me a bit, but the writer that influenced me the most was Leon Uris. I have read Exodus multiple times, and I'm very proud to own a signed copy of Exodus by him, and he influenced me as much as anyone in terms of telling a story.
Have Israelis read this, and what was their experience of it?
I think that there hasn't yet been any Israelis that have read it, but I don't believe that it's necessary because it's such a universal book. You could be in China and read the story and say, oh, this is really fascinating. But I have a feeling Israelis will definitely like the book because so much of it takes place in Israel and it's supportive of Israel. And I think that Americans will particularly like the story because it's kind of American-based fiction, even though the story takes place all over the world with Israel playing a major part.
In writing The Sword of David and now getting it out, what do you want people to take away from the book?
There's a heavy theme of how Jews have been persecuted forever. And we have been, and I think that's undeniable. And we even see today the rise of anti-Semitism and false propaganda about Israel and its role in the Middle East, and particularly its alleged mistreatment of the Palestinians without assessing any fault to Hamas or the PA. And what I hope people would take out of it is that we deserve a break. That we're good people, we've done nothing to earn this terrible false reputation, and that maybe because of the ending, people might look at us slightly different.
I want to thank Charles Lichtman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called The Sword of David, a thriller. It lives up to that subtitle. Tell us where people can find out more about you and where they can find out more about The Sword of David.
Sure. You can go to my website. It's www.chucklichtman.com. It's L-I-C-H-T-M-A-N. And you can buy the book pretty much anywhere, but Amazon has it available right now for pre-order. And I know Barnes & Noble and every other bookseller will be carrying the book.
Charles, thank you so much. Best of luck with The Sword of David.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Joshua Green, the excellent nonfiction author of the New York Times bestselling biography, Unstoppable. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Jewish High Holy Days, a time when you can come and join us in person at Congregation Beit Simcha for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, to sign up for a beautiful, meaningful, musical High Holy Day experience for the 5782 year. Our playout comes from the only woman to have a best-selling album in every decade from the 1960s to the 2020s, Barbara Streisand's recording of Janowski's Avinu Malkeinu for Rosh Hashanah, Monday night and Tuesday, September 6th and 7th, second day is the 8th. The story is that Streisand first got the score for this great piece from my dad when he was the cantor at Temple Emanuel in Beverly Hills, and she attended his High Holy Day services. And don't forget that you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and every Friday night for services and Onik Shabbat, Kiddush, starting at 6:30 p.m. Friday, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services and Torah reading. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.